So with Valentine's Day fast and awkwardly approaching on Wednesday evening, work and school night for most families, many people are struggling more than usual with what is the right thing to do this year. Now, I can only speak from the male perspective here, so and I know that there's a diversity of couples in the congregation, but just speaking for me, and maybe you're a guy who has a spouse and you're really good at keeping up with the four mandatory holidays, Christmas, Valentine's Day, your anniversary, and your partner's birthday. But I am not. I'm not real good at that. Each one of them strikes terror into my heart. Valentine's Day is really especially hard. It is the Goldilocks problem. What is too little? What is too much? What is just right? Card seems too little. Maybe a gift and an expensive dinner out is too much, especially on Wednesday. So should I cook in? You get the picture. And Valentine's Day actually makes me squirm a little for another reason, a theological reason. Ministers are the only people who squirm for theological reasons. It's a holiday that's dedicated to love, and love is the most overused and the least understood word in the English language. We all hope to find it in family, in friendships, in partnerships, and we all aspire to express it. I'm going to be less interested in exploring love today, which is our theme for worship for this month, as personal fulfillment in a romantic relationship, but as personal accountability in any relationship that is important to you. In a marriage, in a family, in an important friendship, and in a religious community like this one, we often talk about love being at the center and that it holds these relationships together. But I think that when we do that, we must recognize we're talking about a love that has more to do with just your personal fulfillment and companionship. And if we look at love from a theological perspective, especially a Western theological perspective, there's an astonishing progression in Christian history about what love means. And it's reflected in the reading that I offered to begin today from 1 John. In the religious culture of a small group of Jews in Palestine in the first century, an astonishing thing happens because of the ways that they followed the executed teacher Jesus of Nazareth. They began talking with each other and preaching a new understanding of what love meant to anybody who would listen to them. It was an understanding that was based on their experiencing God in a new way. So what had changed for them? For these Jews, Hebrew people who had followed Jesus, the tradition in which they were raised told them, among other things, that the fear of God is what keeps them from sinning. God is mysterious, speaks to people from the whirlwind, from thick darkness, through the voices of the prophets, which are so often judgmental and warning voices. You contrast this with what I just read to you from 1 John, the letter from the New Testament. Where is that fear of God, which keeps us from sinning, in that message? The thick darkness in the Hebrew scriptures may still be a cloud of unknowing, and John's letter tells us nobody has seen God. But the letter goes on to say, we can experience God. We can know God in ordinary life experiences, and particularly in the relationships of love that we sustain. More importantly, the letter implies that those loving relationships are not just defined by the bounds of tribe. Jews among Jews, Romans among Romans. The love of God is the love we find between human beings that crosses those boundaries. The love that unites us all as family. If we love one another, God lives in us, the letter says. And with the popularity of the Christian message immensely amplified by its adoption by the Roman Empire, this understanding of God became incorporated into the culture of the Christian West. And while some Christian sects still emphasized God as a judge who ruled over us through moral and social laws, the picture of God instead as a parent whose judgments and discipline should be seen more in the context of human parents, rooted in love and in the best interest of the child, became much more widespread. And then even in the person of Jesus and in the articulation of the doctrine of the Trinity, which isn't all that popular in Unitarian churches, I understand, but where a human Jesus becomes an expression of God, we see Christianity expressing a confidence in ordinary human love, not just as an impulse that supports procreation and stability in a tribe, but as a gift and an expression of a relationship with the divine. I think this is essentially a mystical understanding of love, and it's influenced our culture. We see loving relationships as the place where we find deep and fulfilling emotional experience that's the closest thing in everyday life to mystical union with God. Whether it is a mother describing her bonding with her first child, or two lovers in the first throes of acknowledging their romantic attraction, or the ripe and mature love of those celebrating golden wedding anniversaries. You know, the card shops and the poetry books are filled with tributes to this kind of love as the most sublime experience a human being can have. And so they should be. It's one of the best things about being human. It sets us apart from other creatures in an important way. And when I think about my own life experiences and I think about the 2 years when my wife Kathleen and I were falling in love and then kind of crazy in love, they really are two of the most memorable best years of my life. And they are that way for me because I had this sense that I was receiving something that I had done nothing to deserve. And being in a love that was being called forth from me gave me a willingness to risk intimacy and depth in a way that I'd never done before. And we had the greatest time during those 2 years. Then we decided to get married. Now, I knew that would get a laugh, even though there is no obvious joke there. And you laugh because it is common knowledge, at least among married people, that the ecstatic years of falling in love and being in love in that way are time-bound. That kind of love absolutely does not conquer all. Like everything else that we experience, intense romantic love is impermanent. Doesn't mean love ends. On the contrary, lots of long-term partnerships and marriages in this room and among our friends and our families that are testimony to that. But falling in love and staying in love involve different things as time goes on. So let's go a little further in our exploration of love to understand why that intensely emotional, even mystical dimension of love can't be the be-all and the end-all of our understanding. Love in personal relationships and in other important relationships that we have in our lives has not been fulfilled or fully expressed until it's based not only on mutual emotional satisfaction, but on mutual accountability. Now, accountability is not really a word you immediately warm up to, you know. In public context, especially, accountability is what we want from politicians or police officers or anybody who has a power over us, but accountability is not talked about as much in the context of personal relationships or spiritual practices. The word has two related meanings. You're accountable when you have to explain yourself or justify yourself to somebody else, and something that you do is accountable if it's explicable, if your explanation for it is understood by someone else. We don't much aspire to accountability in our culture. We aspire instead to things like being free and independent and self-reliant and liberated. That better describes our hopes for our lives. But accountable? Not so much. That sounds like something kids have to be to their teachers in school, or something you owe to a boss, or something the police officer requests of you when you're stopped for speeding. In spiritual life, accountability sounds also like it's on that side of the images that we have of God that are associated with fear. And so I want to go back to that, what I was talking about earlier. You know, the move from a God of judgment and law to a God that's understood as love. And let me talk about it from a different angle, because I was talking to a friend about this sermon, and he was telling me a story about a different kind of love and accountability that might illustrate what I'm talking about. This UU friend said to me, what you're talking about in marriages actually connects to an experience I had with my dad when he was introducing me to hiking and a love for the natural world that he always had. He would take me out on long hikes and introduce me to all of the joys of camping. And then he would tell me that we had to pay a price for this. And the price was not just cleaning up after ourselves and hauling out our garbage. We had to somehow feel that we were personally accountable for the ecosystem in the areas of the country where we love to hike, and that we needed to make sure that wild territory was somehow sustainable in a future where there were a lot of threats and a lot of humanity impinging on that. So his dad connected this son and their time together and the love they felt for each other and the love of hiking to environmental activism. And it made a huge difference in both of their lives as they started to share not only their love for hiking, but this mutual commitment as they both got older. They expanded their love for each other and hiking into something larger, into a mutual accountability for a reality bigger than both of them that they had to feel personally responsible for. I think when we become part of a congregation like this one, and we are invited to explore all the opportunities for community and for personal growth and satisfying new relationships, we are also invited into something else that resonates with this story I've just told, into a relationship of accountability with something that's bigger than all of that. We've been having conversations over the last few months about how you use this interim time, this in-between time, to create a healthy relationship with your next settled minister. And in these conversations, you may have, I may have asked this question privately to some of you, but I'm not sure I've asked it from the pulpit yet. The question is, who owns the church? Who owns it? Is it the minister? Shake your heads, it's not. No. Is it the board? Well, they kind of represent the owners, but they don't own it. A lot of people would say, you know, it's the members. I did too, actually, for a long time. But then I heard a different answer that made a lot of sense to me. The owner of the church is its mission. The mission is what we said we wanted the church to be and do to make the world a better place. So you have your mission on the wall outside these doors. I don't know if you can recite it. To love, grow, and serve boldly. You went to some trouble and you had some important conversations to arrive at that mission. So what does that mean for us today and for the next ministry? All of us are accountable to that mission if we are members of this church. The mission owns the church, and the mission owns us. Connect this back to the understanding about what happens in a healthy marriage, represented by the lines from Wendell Berry's poem that Kim read. He confesses early in that reading that his marriage at the beginning was a little economy based on the exchange of my love and work for yours, so much for so much of an expendable fund. And then he points to a different possibility in a truly accountable, loving relationship. we are more together than we know. How else could we keep discovering that we are more together than we ever thought? When Kathleen and I were married, our ceremony included a poem called The Third Body by Robert Bly. And it's one that we come back to, and I come back to often when I talk about these issues in church, privately or in the pulpit. And I want to share it. My only hesitation in doing that is the language evokes only a heterosexual couple. So I beg the indulgence and imaginations of our same-sex couple friends who I'm sure know the reality of this poem equally well. The poem reads, "A man and a woman sit near together, and they do not long at this moment to be older or younger or born in any other nation or other time or any other place. They are content to be where they are, talking or not talking. Their breath together feeds someone we do not know. The man sees the way his fingers move. He sees her hands close around a book she hands to him. They obey a third body they have in common. They have promised to love that body. Age may come, parting may come, death will come. A man and a woman sit near together. As they breathe, they feed someone we do not know, someone we know of, whom we have never seen." The initial attractions of romance and family and friendship and community sit at the core of any long-term relationship. They are still the glowing coals that keep generating heat and light. But the warmth in any relationship over time depends on the container that holds that fire. And accountability to that container is accountability to the third body. 1 John offers the revolutionary spiritual insight that if we love one another, God lives in us. So no matter whether we are theists or atheists or agnostics in our attitude about how this world came to be, there is something compelling and truthful about seeing divinity in that third body of our most important relationships, the body that we know of, but that we've never seen. The spiritual life is ultimately a search for how and to what you can give yourself away to. And you can spend your days holding on tightly to this personal possession of a life that you find yourself living and that you've been given, keeping it safe and secure like a vintage car that you keep all shiny and polished in a garage and take out on the road for parades on sunny days. Or you can recognize that you're never going to be able to risk manage your way through relationships and that your accountability is not just to your own needs, but to the possibility that that third body, that common life, that two people or a family or a church community can create and share is something that you can be part of. Everyday relationships are the known way, as Wendell Berry describes them, the known way that leads us always to the unknown, and that unknown will be what points us home.